I'd like to talk to you about modeling of pulsar magnetospheres. So it's a problem of long history and interesting physics. And for me, as a physicist, it's a very beautiful problem. So I'm attracted to very beautiful and simple problems. And this is a very beautiful and simple sounding problem. And it has attracted a lot of people, like, you know, fruit flies to the fire. A lot of them got burned. But nevertheless, the problem is still cool. So I'll try to convince you of that. So it also comes with lots of astronomy to it. So pulsars are not imaginary objects that actually exist. So these are, we think these are neutron stars with strong magnetic fields, so around 10 to the 12 Gauss or larger for normal pulsars. And we detect them producing periodic pulses. So canonically, they're detected as radio pulsars. So a lot of them produce these radio pulses. You can see pulse to pulse, there is some variability in the emission. But then when you sum it up together over a long time scale, you see a very stable pulse shape. And this pulse shape is just repeating and repeating. And you can do amazing things for timing pulsars. You can learn a lot of things about neutron stars this way. The fact that the pattern is stable tells you that there is some sort of rigid something that's anchoring the emission. And that something is thought to be the magnetic field. So these are strongly magnetized, fastly rotating neutron stars. So the periods go from milliseconds to several seconds. And they are born in supernova remnants. So so for example, Crab pulsar is sitting in the middle of this Crab nebula here. This is in optical. The pulsars are not just radio pulsars. They're actually very broadband emitters. So they, what's shown here is several pulsars in different bands. So that's going from radio, optical, X-rays, and then gamma rays. So you can see that in some pulsars, you can get emission all over the emission range. And anywhere in the radio, in the electromagnetic spectrum, they seem to be producing pulses, although sometimes the pulses are not aligned. So sometimes radio pulses are not aligned with the gamma ray pulses, for example. It's just one puzzle we'll try to explain. So pulsars, at least the young ones, being in the middle of supernova remnants, causes an extra component to this story. So they also are powering what's called pulsar wind nebulae. So in the middle of Crab Nebula, for example, over here, so this is all optical line emission, but this faint blue glow that you can see in there is actually synchrotron emission coming from relativistic particles. And in X-rays, that synchrotron emission looks like this. So the crab is sitting in the center there. And you see this torus of enhanced emission. Also, you see jets that seem to come from the pulsar itself, but yes. Isn't it? Yeah. So this is actually X-ray image from Chandra. I wish it was a simulation. It's too beautiful for that. I'll show you. Some modern simulations start to reproduce this look. I mean, this is now a much larger scale than the neutron star. So this is now 0.1 parsec. This inner ring is about 0.1 parsec in radius. So what's happening here is that the pulsar is emitting a wind, which is carrying relativistic particles, and these particles are then radiating synchrotron emission in the magnetic fields in the nebula. And there are many examples. Here's another one, here's another one now seen in the ultra high energy gamma rays. So this is a gamma ray emission from a nebula powered by a particular pulsar. So we think that the emission from the nebula itself has, it's powered by the particles emitted by the pulsar. However, the spectra of the energy of the emission are generated at these at shocks that are generated in the outflowing wind. So the particles are supplied by the pulsar, but they're reaccelerated at these termination shocks. And then the spectra that are generated by these shocks is what's powering the emission in the nebula. So here's a spectrum of a pulsar wind nebula. So this is Crab Nebula, it's again going from radio to X-rays, and then there is an inverse Compton peak over here. So that's what's seen with ultra high energy gamma ray observations. Okay, so let's go back to the actual pulsar machine. And so as I said, there are these pulses observed in various bands. If you ask where is most of the observed energy coming from, so in what band does most of the observed energy gets emitted, you find that the thing that which makes pulsars famous, which is the radio emission, is actually a completely insignificant amount of energy. So some people describe it as a whistle on the locomotive. So the power in the locomotive is not in the whistle, right? And but this is the thing that actually warns you about the locomotive. So the actual power in the pulsar, if you just look in the electromagnetic bands, most of the energy is actually coming in the gamma rays. So those are, and by most here, well, so, okay, so we'll get back to that. So if you look at the log energy distribution versus the luminosity, you will find that most energy is coming out at the highest energy bands. Overall, the energy reservoir for a neutron star is the energy of the rotation, right? And the rate at which it slows down as it emits radiation and wind is the energy reservoir that you can tap. So the brightest electromagnetic radiation that we observe, which is these gamma rays, is at most about 10% of that spin down energy. So even in the brightest electromagnetic band, we're still not seeing the whole thing. The whole thing is responsible for the slowdown of the pulsars. So this is just three different bands here. So if you actually time the radio emission, what you will see is that the radio pulses slow down. So that means that the rotating neutron star is slowing down. And you can ask how much energy did that take. So what is the energy loss rate there? And this is what's called the pulsar spin down. And you can plot it on this PP dot diagram. So what's shown here is the period of the pulsar versus the period derivative, how fast it slows down, and the rate of slowing down. And what you find is that most pulsars are following, are supposed to be following this kind of track in this PP dot diagram. So they're moving roughly along these straight lines. Their period is slowing down. Their period derivative is also changing. And the amount of energy that's being emitted in the process of spin down is roughly the amount of energy that gets finally deposited into the nebula. So the synchrotron emission from the nebula is maybe 20-30% of this invisible spin down energy loss. So it's very interesting to understand how this spin down energy actually is being lost. What is actually going on? Where is most of the energy going? And then it would be nice to understand on top of that, what is the radiation mechanisms and what is the physics that's resulting in the gamma rays or radio that we're observing? Yeah, it's a plot that I stole from someone. So I guess here you can see two main distributions of pulsars. This is what's called the regular pulsars, and these are called recycled pulsars and millisecond pulsars. So there are two populations. We think that these are young, so these are born in supernova remnants, in supernova explosions, and then those that are in binaries get spun up due to extra accretion. So that's an evolutionary process. But most, we think, are born with around 10 to the 12 Gauss, and then they end up being, some of them being, if they're in binaries, get recycled and come up as millisecond pulsars. Okay, so why are pulsars interesting right now? So I think they have always been kind of a unique laboratory for matter in very strange environments. So very strong magnetic fields, very strong gravity, and relativistic plasmas in these environments as well. This electromagnetic energy loss, so going from a rotating object through magnetic fields into an energy output that slows down your object, is kind of this generic physics is very applicable in other environments. So for example, the AGNs, black hole magnetospheres, accretion disk magnetospheres, all seem to share this characteristic physics, how to transfer rotating energy into the pointing flux energy. So they're kind of, pulsars are kind of a prototype. And for me as a physicist, I think they're just incredible electromagnetic machines. So and that's what I'm very interested in. So what is an incredible, incredible machine? So here's an example of one. It's a self-operating napkin, so you can trace how this thing works. Once you start eating with a spoon, I think this whole thing, chain reaction goes on, and the napkin wipes your face. So what are the ingredients of an incredible machine? So the incredible machine has to have an energy source. It has to have a convoluted mechanism, and it needs to exist for some reason. And so there's a sense of purpose or observables that are associated with this incredible machine. So pulsars are incredible machine because they have all of these components. So the energy source, as I'll argue, is what's called unipolar induction. There is very convoluted mechanism that goes in the process. So we don't understand how radio emission is happening or any other kind of emission for real, but there are some ideas. And finally, the sense of purpose of this incredible machine is that it slows down the neutron star, it generates a wind, and it generates light. So basically, what I would like to discuss is the open questions in the modeling of these machines. The various approaches we go with to model this machine, and those approaches have various pros and cons, there are limitations, and there are some successes as well recently. And also, I'll argue for something that we didn't expect when we started modeling these things, is that magnetic reconnection turns out to be a very important contributor to at least the high energy emission in pulsars. So I'll explain why that is the case. So generically, over 40 years, pulsars as a field have been observationally driven. So whenever I go to pulsar conferences, there is always these talks about, oh, we found the fastest pulsar, the largest pulsar, the coolest pulsar, the hottest pulsar. So there are all these observers that are just running to the finish line, outrunning each other. And it's really an observationally driven subject, which is kind of fun to be in. On the other hand, being a theorist at pulsar conferences, I sometimes feel like this, that we're still kind of tying our shoelaces and we haven't entered the race yet. But the moment we tie all the last shoelace, we'll be ready to run. So the open questions that we're trying to understand, basically, they're still the same questions as we had 40 years ago. What is the structure of pulsar magnetospheres? So if I give you a neutron star with magnetic field, I spin it, what does it look like? You know, it's a simple problem. There should be a solution. What kind of wind does it emit? What are the properties of the outflow? And then on top of that, what is causing the pulse emission in various bands? And how do you generate the spectra that we're observing? So from all of these questions, the structure of the magnetosphere is kind of fundamental. This is the background on top of which you need to build everything. And this is the place where this is the place which took the longest to understand how to solve. And I'll explain the current ideas on these solutions. And so let me just explain the basic physics here. So you can do this at home. So this experiment really demonstrates pulsar physics. So what you need are three components. So you need a small refrigerator magnet. It's actually a neodymium magnet here. You need a small battery. And you need a piece of copper wire. So you tie them together. So you attach a battery to the magnet. These are not my hands. Then the whole thing just holds onto the wire here with magnetic force, and then you connect the circuit. So if you don't believe me, I challenge you to do this at home. It spins. So what's going on here? Do you have any idea why is it spinning? So what's happening, right, is that there is a voltage provided by the battery, right? And so the magnet here is at a certain potential, right? And so there is a potential difference between the center of the magnet and the edge, right? Because it's there, well, the moment they're connected by wire, this potential from here gets connected to the edge. So there is a current that starts to flow through this circuit, right? And that current is crossing the magnetic field. There is a J cross B force, right? And that J cross B force is starting to rotate the magnet. So in a sense, this whole picture was a pulsar, a pulsar in reverse, in a sense. So if I started with a magnet spinning, then that would generate potential difference between the center and the edge of the magnet. And then if I could connect it with a circuit, it will send a current that will slow down the star. So basically, the whole thing is analogous to what's known as a Faraday disk or unipolar inductor. So if you have a conductor immersed in the magnetic field, you start spinning it. The way to think about it is that there is a Lorentz force acting on the individual little electrons in the middle of your conductor, right? And that separates the charges. So the electrons go one way, the positive charges go the other way, and this with this Lorentz force. And that makes a potential difference between the center and the edge. So you have a little bit of an excess of charge on this end. Okay? So there is now a potential difference. And now if you could tap this potential difference, you can draw current and you can power a light. The difficulty is how to close the circuit. And you can do simple estimates, and the simple estimates basically that the voltage is given by the enclosed flux and the spin of the star, and the power that you generate is just voltage squared divided by the characteristic resistance in the circuit. And that gives you roughly scaling that you would need. So the power of like 10 to the 38 ergs per second is what you would get for a neutron star. You can scale it also for black holes in active galactic nuclei and so forth. Okay, so the simplest question that I wanted to understand is this. So you have a spherical conductor. It's endowed with dipolar magnetic field. You spin it, and then what? So what happens then? So if the field is very strong and the work function is very small on the surface, this strong induced electric field can pull out charges, and that can really screw up your physics. So basically what happens is that plasma happens, right? So the plasma will get thrown into the magnetosphere, and that plasma will carry charges and currents that will modify the field. And that's what you need to be able to solve. So first of all, let's talk about where the charges come from. So on this, again, this spinning neutron star will have a potential difference between the pole and the equator. So outside the neutron star, you will have kind of a quadrupolar electric field, right? So if you have, say, negative pole, positive equator, you will have quadrupolar electric fields. So there will be places where there will be electric field aligned with magnetic field. So it will be non-zero E dot B. And that can pull charges out of the surface if the surface has very low work function. So then you will have electrons trying to fly up on the field lines. When the field is very strong and curved, these relativistic electrons curving on magnetic field lines will radiate gamma rays. And then as those gamma rays cross magnetic field lines, you can get pair production. So you get basically gamma-gamma pair production, where one gamma is provided by the magnetic field. And then you would form a lot of dense pair plasma. And that lot of dense pair plasma will try to short out the accelerating electric field that was there in the first place. But you will end up with a magnetosphere filled with relativistic particles. So that's the zeroth order idea. It has never been actually demonstrated to work from first principles in the way that I just described. But people agree that there will be a kind of a gap here where particles are accelerated, then there is a pair production region, and then something happens to the magnetosphere. So the characteristic quantity here is the amount of charges that you will extract from the surface and the amount of charges that you can have in the magnetosphere. So the the characteristic quantity is what's called the Goldreich-Julian charge density. This is the minimal charge density you need to have in the magnetosphere in order for the magnetic field lines to rotate with the rotation speed of the star. So you can just derive it very simply, say that electric field is the what's called co-rotation electric field, what you would need to rotate the magnetic field lines with, in rigid co-rotation with the star. That's electric field transfers to the magnetic field. And then take a divergence of that, you will get some charge density. So basically, there should be some charge density in the magnetosphere in order to give you electric field to rotate. That's what's called the Goldberg-Julian charge density. Then the characteristic, if that charge density is relativistic, so it's moving at the speed of light, there is a characteristic current density, also called Goldberg-Julian current density. It has this expression. So the question is, what would happen to this magnetosphere if you send a kind of a current of this magnitude up the magnetic field lines and have these charges in the magnetosphere rotating the magnetosphere? What would happen? All of these things can modify the field structure, right? Because the current will make toroidal fields, the electric charges will make magnetosphere rotate, and something will proceed. So yellow thing is what I call the paraformation front. So it's the field lines are black lines here. So imagine that there's dipolar field lines close to the star. Yellow thing is where the pairs are becoming like an avalanche. So you will get, because secondary, the moment you produce pairs, they also radiate gamma quanta, and you can get more pairs. And so you get a very, very sharp turn on of the plasma. OK, so this picture is a kind of a very local model. And there's been a lot of work done on these kind of local models. The problem with it is that the boundary conditions on this region have to come from the magnetosphere farther out. And those you assume. And so you're bound to create some solution that may not necessarily agree with what the magnetosphere wants. So this kind of a local current and charge creation model, which may not necessarily be the correct one. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
So
it's
very small, it's very small, right? It's a few kilometers for a typical neutron star. So
right,
what determines this is what? So radius is 10 kilometers. So circumference is 60 kilometers.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not tiny, but it's not very large. Right? So okay. So if you generate this kind of Goldberg-Julian charge density, what will happen is it will send out, let's say that there is a current flowing along these field lines. There is electric field over here to provide co-rotation. So if there are charges in here to provide the rotation of these field lines, the current moving up will create toroidal magnetic field. So you will start getting sweepback of magnetic field, right? And now you have the situation where you have a sweepback of magnetic field, so the toroidal magnetic field and the poloidal electric field, right? And that gives you an E cross B vector, right? E cross B vector is going out in the radial direction, right? So just this very fact of rotating this field created a pointing flux. So E cross B is a pointing flux. You can integrate it over the sphere, and you will get a net loss of energy. So this rotating star is sending out pointing flux. It's losing energy to electromagnetic fields. Note that there is nothing oscillating here. There is no like time-dependent variation like you would get in an antenna, for example. It's purely just a steady-state energy loss. Okay. All right, so that's the idea. Now, if you go for a more generic configuration, an oblique rotator, there you may get also time-dependent features. So you will get sweepback not only from the currents, but also because of the time rate of change of the magnetic field. And another thing you realize is that the moment there is some characteristic scale of the magnetosphere. And that scale, what we call, is the light cylinder. So if you were to correlate in complete correlation with the star, you can only go so far, right? Because at some point, your correlation velocity will start exceeding speed of light. So something should happen there. It doesn't have to be very dramatic, but something should happen to the field structure. In fact, what you find is that the field can no longer be closed, so there will be open field lines which do not come back to the star. So there is a characteristic transition region. So we want to model this kind of a magnetosphere. So there are two paths that you can take modeling this magnetosphere. And those two paths vary, in a sense, by the assumed amount of plasma in the magnetosphere. So if you assume that there is, so the question is there dense plasma? And dense, what I mean here is density of the plasma much larger than this canonical Goldreich-Julian density. Okay, so if there is not enough plasma, then you will not short out all of the accelerating electric fields. You will still have accelerating electric fields, and you will get what we call a charge-separated magnetosphere. So there will be regions of plasma of one sign only in different places in the magnetosphere, and there will be still accelerating electric fields. So that's the original idea proposed by Goldreich-Julian, where before people realized that you can have pair formation and you can actually create a lot of plasma much larger than this canonical Goldreich-Julian density. That's one direction, and I'll show you some examples of that. Another direction is, let's say that there is a lot of plasma. Something created a lot of plasma. Let's say that was pair formation or some magic. You just dump a lot of dense plasma. By dense, I mean, again, it's just in terms of the shorting out of the electric fields, not necessarily by mass. So the mass of the plasma can still be insignificant compared to electromagnetic fields. So, and that's usually a good approximation because the fields are so strong. Even if you throw what I call very dense plasma, it doesn't have enough mass to disturb the fields. But it has enough charges to short out accelerating fields. So that branch of the solution is what I call the MHD or force-free solutions. So these more or less short out accelerating fields, and you can model the magnetosphere using equations of magnetohydrodynamics or its brother, the force-free electrodynamics. So those are the two extremes. Well, you don't. So there is some constraints. So one constraint we have is we can figure out how much plasma should be fed into the pulsar wind nebula. So if we look at larger scales, we can figure out how many particles per second should the Crab pulsar produce in order to see the luminosity that we observe from the nebula. And if you extrapolate it back to the star, you will find out that the number of the density of plasma that you need to produce is about 10 to the 6 times the Goldreich-Julian density. So something should be generating the plasma, a lot of dense plasma. Yeah, so when you do this, also you can do the models of these cascades, which are very local and decoupled from the magnetosphere, but still give you some information. And there you can get factors of like 10 to the 4 easily. But the thing is that this kind of an MHD solution shorts out all accelerating electric fields, so there shouldn't be any particle acceleration in the magnetosphere, so there shouldn't be any radiation in the magnetosphere. So these models, in a sense, can throw the baby with the bathwater, right? They're missing something else. So I think the reality may be lying somewhere in between. So you may have dense plasma in some regions, and you may not have enough plasma in some other regions, so you can still have these accelerating potential drops, and you can still have what we call gaps. Okay, so there is a whole branch of this pulsar science which I call gapology, where people try to insert various gaps into the pulsar magnetosphere and try to accelerate particles there. The problem is that they're usually very decoupled from the global structure, so they're kind of very local models. And recently, there's been some developments in what I will call resistive MHD, or resistive force-free models, where people start to unify some of these ideas of the gaps with ideas of the force-free or MHD models. So we go into what I call resistive MHD. So resistive MHD means that you you do not short out all of the accelerating electric fields, yet you still have dense enough plasma to be in this MHD-like regime. So you can kind of recover the advantages of both limits, and hopefully this is more realistic. And I'll show you some examples of that. So if you like to think, vacuum limit is, the glass is completely empty. When the plasma limit is, glass is completely full, and in the middle you want to be either half full or half empty, depending on your optimism. Okay, so this is basically a dense table of various models of pulsar magnetospheres that have been proposed. Basically, they go by the amount of plasma in the magnetosphere. So this vacuum field, this is what I call space charge limited or space charge separated flows, and going all the way out to abundant plasma regime. So the field properties vary between, so just the basic background solution. So in vacuum field, you have a rotating vacuum dipole, which is an exact analytic solution you can derive. And that's what's nice about it, is that this is a actually analytical formula. You can take it from the book and use it for many purposes. Everything else is numerical solutions. So it has certain advantages, but as I'll show, it has certain disadvantages as well. So various models have different amount of acceleration. So in the vacuum model, you will have wild acceleration because all of the electric fields are still unshorted. So you can get ridiculous energies. And the amount of acceleration decreases as you go to more and more abundant plasma. And what's important also is the measure of the spin down energy loss. So how much electromagnetic flux does the pulsar lose? So in vacuum, this is an analytic formula you can derive. And this is a sign of the inclination angle of the magnetic axis to the rotation axis. So what you can see here is that for aligned pulsar, so when magnetic axis is parallel to the rotation axis, it loses nothing. There is no spin down energy loss. So in vacuum, that pulsar is not radiating. When you turn on the plasma, this is a result that they actually obtained numerically. You actually get radiation. You get electromagnetic energy loss even for an aligned rotator. So that's a big qualitative difference, right? You stick a magnet onto the star, it either loses energy or it doesn't lose energy. That's a 100% effect. Yes. By relativistic, you mean gravity? Or?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's right. So typically, the good or the bad news is that, good for me, bad for him, is that the typically corrections are about 10%. So the compactness of neutron stars is such that the corrections close to the star give you about 10% corrections if you do it in full GR. So
this formula they don't have, right?
This is pure class, this is, just flat space.
But in GR, you get pretty much the same.
You get exactly the same. Well, large number.
But that's
small.
But it's small.
Okay.
Then
if you let it collapse from the star to black hole, then
you'd be able to see more interesting. Right. Yeah. If you go to full black hole, then I guess mu goes to zero. Is that? I'm just wondering whether there's a conspiracy that even the relativistic limit.
Well, for black hole, you would have to do something about the field, right? Where does the field come from? Because neutron stars are happy to hold on to the field. Black hole.
That's
so if you put it in an external field, then you will get something like this. But
I think Marcelo was doing something else. When you put this in addition to that, an external magnetic field, you get another component, and it goes like 1 plus cosine squared rather than 1 plus sine squared. So you're going to have two combinations.
If you put
an external field. Maybe,
For black hole.
Okay, so let me just march through these different solutions. So let's first talk about the vacuum rotator. So this is the analytic shape of the vacuum magnetosphere. So this is a looking in the poloidal plane. So the mu omega, so the magnetic axis is flowing in and out of the screen. The rotation axis along Z. It's basically an electromagnetic wave. It radiates an electromagnetic wave. You have an analytic formula for the field. The problem with this solution is that all field lines are technically closed. So all field lines can be traced back down to the star. There is no clear separation between closed and open field lines. This is what it looks like from the pole. All of these field lines eventually come back. So they even though it looks like there is a kind of a current sheet, it's really just an illusion. Okay, so this is the vacuum field. Another extreme is let's say we start with vacuum field and add particles, right? So let's just do an experiment where we allow particles to escape from the surface, and let's not have any pair formation. Let's just allow these particles to fly from the surface. And whatever sign of charge is needed locally, that's the sign of charge you will produce. This is the kind of solution you find. This is very peculiar. So what you find is that, remember, there was a quadrupolar electric field on the star. So it pulls out negative charges on the poles, and it pulls out positive charges in the equatorial regions. And the equatorial particles have nowhere to go because there are closed field lines here. So they kind of stick around the star. They don't allow the electrons to escape either, because the star charges up if electrons start to leave very far. So you get this weird solution which we call electrospheres, which we don't exactly know what to do with it. It's not a Golarg-Julian solution. It doesn't produce outflows, it just sits there more or less. So if you don't have any pair formation, it seems to be sitting there. It's not a completely dead solution. There are some weird non-axisymmetric instabilities that happen. So this is the same picture in colloidal projection. So this is the electron, this is the positive particles, whatever they are. It turns out that this equatorial region is actually differentially shearing. So it's not in correlation with the star. It's purely a charge-separated instability. It's a charge-separated flow, and charge-separated flows in magnetic fields can shear. You get a kind of an analog of Kelvin-Helmholtz instability in this equatorial region, which kind of spreads the charges out. We're not completely sure what to do with this so far. We don't know what the ultimate state of this evolution is. It requires some numerical. It becomes a numerically challenging problem to simulate. But
this is not realistic, right?
You don't
expect this much charge separation. Right?
Why not?
I suppose because of pair creation.
Right. So if you have fields strong enough to form pairs, then yes. But what if you have a weak field or slow rotation? Maybe this is the way neutron stars look when they're not pulsars.
You're saying a very slow rotation? This is how they look like. But then if it's a slow rotation, there isn't much charge separation.
Well, there will be as much as, the Golarg-Julian density is still there. So omega dot B is the charge density. But all I'm saying is that if there is, at some point pulsars turn off. And presumably it's because they don't have enough pairs. But maybe that's the way those magnetospheres look like. So, I'm just throwing it out there. I don't propose this as a pulsar model, but this is where we get to if we actually do it honestly, without pair formation. So there may be still some life to this. It may still produce an outflow. We're not completely sure. So something like that has been recently done by this group, Yuki and Shibata. So they have added some pair formation, but they claim to get an outflow. Yet they still have very large accelerating potentials in the magnetosphere. So that, my feeling is that they didn't add enough plasma. So basically, what they see is that there are particles flying at relativistic velocities, just being torn out from the magnetic field and just flying on straight lines. So they can get outflows, but I feel that these magnetospheres don't have the right pair formation prescription to short out all of the fields. Okay, so so this kind of idea of having particles that are not occupying all of the field lines, and you have some field lines where you can have gaps, has generated a lot of progress in the modeling of pulsars. So these people can calculate, so if you have dense plasma here and dense plasma here, and there is a gap, you can calculate electric field, and you can accelerate particles in this field, and you can construct models of emissions. So this has been a workhorse for calculating various properties of pulsar emission. Unfortunately, it was based on the vacuum field, because that's the only background magnetic field that is analytically known. So that the background of this solution had to be fixed. And that, in a sense, it's non-self-consistent. So this has resulted in a, whenever you hear talk about pulsars, people say words gaps. So you hear outer gaps, inner gaps, polar gaps. So this is the idea. So you can have the slot gaps. So these are the gaps between the closed field lines and the open field lines, where the pair formation is thought to be not efficient. There are also what are called the outer gaps, which are the I'm not going to talk about it because it's I think it's all wrong. I don't want to even. It's like, you know. Okay. It's like telling a story about religion, which I don't want to do. Let me skip.
You realize you're being recorded.
I know. I chose my words sort of carefully. All right. Let me jump to something more real. So let's take the limit of more plasma. So let's crank up more plasma. And let's go to the limit of what we call full relativistic MHD. So this was a solution that was first done by Sergei Komissarov in 2006. And what's shown here is the kind of solution one gets if you include full relativistic MHD and the rotation of the star. Now, the problem with full relativistic MHD is that the evolution equation involving velocities of plasma. So the velocity is entering the momentum equation. And so you're evolving the momentum equation. And the forces on the right-hand side of the momentum equation are electromagnetic forces and plasma forces. And those electromagnetic forces are very large compared to the plasma pressures, for example. And they're nearly canceling each other out. So the electromagnetically, this plasma is very electromagnetically dominated. So the evolution quantities that you're solving, the momentum equation, is a very weak weak function of, it's very, very small number. So you basically end up in a very stiff, with a stiff equation. So the problem with these relativistic MHD models is that maintaining this inner magnetosphere at high magnetization has been a problem. So Komissarov has used a certain trick where he kind of forced the fluid velocities inside of this light cylinder to just do co-rotation. So he killed all of the flow along the magnetic field lines. So one way to simplify this is to go to what we call the force-free simulation and actually remove this problem of very high magnetization in the middle of the pulsar magnetosphere. So since this is a Institute of Theoretical Physics, I'll show you some four tensors. Mm-hmm. And so full MHD is basically solving conservation laws of matter, matter stress energy and the field stress energy. And there is a condition of perfect conductivity that you throw in, and this is the definition of the field and the matter stress tensor. So the advantages of this thing is that you can have all sorts of transfer of energy between fields and matter and the other way around. You can have shocks. You can have dissipation. The problem is that it's very hard to solve in this regime where the charge, mass energy density of the matter is much smaller than the electromagnetic field energy density. So what you can do is you can do a simplification where you throw away the matter and only solve the divergence of the field stress energy. And you still maintain this constraint of the perfect conductivity. And so if you impose this constraint of perfect conductivity, you can formulate equations that don't evolve the matter, just evolve the fields, but still retain the charges and the currents that come from the plasma. And this is what's called the force free limit. So it's great because it can now solve arbitrary magnetization plasmas, but the disadvantage is that you no longer have the plasma there, so you can no longer heat plasma, you can no longer have shocks. And another disadvantage is that sometimes it breaks down. So it only is valid when the magnetic field is larger than the electric field. If you can have regions where electric field starts exceeding the magnetic field, this formulation just goes poof and it breaks. Because in reality, that's the place where plasma can become important. So this is the kind of set of equations that one can solve for this force-free MHD. So basically, it's Maxwell's equations with a condition that the force on the acting on the plasma, the electromagnetic forces, are close to zero. So the total electromagnetic force cancel itself. And that gives you a prescription for the current. You can just derive this current prescription. You can stick it back into the equations. And you can solve for the dynamical evolution of electric and magnetic field. So let me show you the results. So this is the time-dependent evolution of an aligned rotator. So here what you see is the field lines initially were all closed. And then as you spun up the star, the field lines opened up. And what you see here is the color is the toroidal magnetic field. So this is the field coming out or into the plane. And so what you get is this closed and open magnetic field lines. And they're separated over here in the equator by a strong current sheet. So you can see here the toroidal field changes sign. The poloidal field also changes size. So these field lines are attached to the north pole. These field lines are to the south pole. So there is a jump in all quantities. And indeed, if you draw the current, that's where the strongest current flows. So there is distributed current outwards, say, over here. And then there is a return current along the separatrix here and then going along the edge of the closed field lines. Okay. All right, so here we go. That's the aligned rotator. And this is a time-dependent solution that was that we found in 2006. And since then, it's been confirmed by many groups. And you can use it to calculate the spin down. You can use it to predict emission based on the new geometry of the magnetic field. But what's more is that you can extend it to three dimensions. So this is now a three-dimensional force-free simulation where you have an oblique magnetic dipole. And this again has closed and open field lines. And there is a current sheet that flows that used to be in the equator. Now it's a flapping current sheet that goes up and down as the star is spinning. So you can take this solution and measure the spin down rate, just numerically measuring the pointing flux. And what you find is that the aligned rotators do lose energy. And then the oblique rotators are spinning down about twice as fast as the aligned rotator. So finally, you can measure this quantity. And this is a kind of a fit to the spin down. This is not an exact formula. This is a fit from the numerical solution. And not yet. No. Not easily. Yeah, it's to within 10%. Actually, our recent work shows it might be 1.1 or something like that. So it's close to one, but I don't want to make it precise because that people start think that they can derive this. I know. Right. So again, this is some of the slices through the three-dimensional magnetosphere. So you can see here the structure of this current sheet. The good thing about this solution is that it tells you the angular distribution of the pointing flux that you're radiating. And that angular distribution of the pointing flux depends on the toroidal magnetic field. And what you find is that the toroidal magnetic field has a certain angular dependence. And the pointing flux that this radiates is peaked in the equator. So the total energy flux even for the oblique rotator, is peaked in the equatorial direction. And that turns out is actually what you need to explain these morphologies in the Crab Nebula, for example. So when people model this with relativistic MHD on large scales, interaction with the full nebula, they find that they can get these toroidally looking structures if they beam the emission, if the pulsar is producing most of the pointing flux in the equatorial direction. So this is the kind of the, this is the work from Komisarov and Liborsky where they did this numerically, and you can see that, you know, it's not as good color table as the Chandra image, but it's close. Okay, so what are the improvements you can do on top of this, on top of these solutions? Well, this was the ideal solution, right? So what if you start adding a little bit of resistivity and ask, well, what happens if the plasma supply is somewhere in between the full MHD and vacuum? And what we expect is that somehow you will go from the full MHD to vacuum like this. So the spin down should slow down as the plasma supply is decreased. And this is the limit of what I call the resistive force free MHD. We can simulate this now with resistive methods. So here the idea is that we're starting to bring back the electric field, the accelerating electric field. So we're postulating that in some proper frame of the fluid, the current has an Ohm's law depending on the some parameter sigma. Okay, so conductivity. So current is some sigma times proper electric field. And you can go through a nasty derivation and have a prescription for the current in the lab frame that depends on various quantities, which I won't go into. But the basic idea is that you end up with these two terms. One is the advection of charge density with the E cross B velocity. And another term is proportional to conductivity. So this term gives you kind of the parallel current along the magnetic field lines. And you can stick this into the Maxwell's equations and solve this for various prescriptions for various values of sigma. And what we find is that indeed there is a continuum of solutions. For zero conductivity, we get vacuum solutions. For large conductivity, we get these force-free solutions. So there are open and closed field lines again. And then in the middle, you can find anything in between. So as you change sigma from infinity to zero, you can get these in-between solutions. And the spin-down power, as predicted, is varying between the force-free and the vacuum limit. Why this is interesting is because there is a prediction, there are a certain class of interesting pulsars, which are called intermittent pulsars, which seem to have very strange properties. They're on for about a month at a time, and you can measure their spin down, and then they're off, and then you don't see them for about a month, not precisely, but about a month. And then they come back, and you can see that this, if you can't connect this, so this is the rate, this is their period, and you can see that you cannot connect the, this is the frequency, right? You cannot connect the spin down with a straight line, which means that they were spinning down in a different way when they were off, right? So when you didn't see them in radio, they were slowing down in a different rate. So how can that be? What does this mean? The rate, the difference is about 1.5. So there's something about the magnetosphere that is being turning on and off to give you a radio emission, and that seems to be affecting the overall spin down, which is, again, radio emission is a tiny amount of energy, but it's riding on something big, and that's big, something big must be the plasma supply. So something is changing the plasma supply in the magnetosphere. So we can model this with the following prescription. So we're saying that, let's say that some magic killed pair formation, and then the plasma has escaped along the open field lines, and you will have a region of closed field lines which are still filled with plasma, but no plasma on the open field lines. What you find then is solutions for different inclination angles. So this is 30, 60, and 90 degrees. And you can compare them to the full force-free solution. And what you find is that indeed there is some differences, of course. And you can measure the pointing flux. And what you find is that this is the full force-free solution, which we'll call the on state. This is when the radio is being emitted. this is the vacuum, and this is what we call this off state when only part of the magnetosphere is filled with plasma. And the spin down is different from vacuum because there is still plasma sitting on the closed field lines. And we can get this factor 1.5 relatively broad range of inclination angles. And that seems to at least qualitatively explain how this. I wish I knew, right. So we don't know. We don't know what can disrupt. People have proposed meteorites landing on the pulsar. But well, it creates the wind, right?
Right, but
there's
the wave that grows, it gives sufficient fair density there.
So far, there aren't very good ideas, yeah, unfortunately. So the recent developments, let me just skip a few things. The recent developments in this direction, we now have the relativistic MHD that I showed you for the aligned rotator, we now have it in three dimensions. So this is work done by Sasha Tukhovskoy and myself. So basically, so this is now an inclined MHD 3D rotator. So now Sasha's code can go to very large magnetizations, so about 100 or so. So this is an oblique rotator, and he still has to use a trick very well within the light cylinder to hold the plasma, to maintain magnetization in there. But farther out, it's full MHD, and what you get there is, in this current sheet, he now has the plasma. So there is no ambiguities anymore, and there is a plasma pressure that exists in the current sheet. Superficially, it looks very much like a force-free solution, as it should, because we're in the limit of very strong magnetization. But the good thing is that we now have some plasma in the current sheet, and that velocity can be used for, say, beaming of the emission and so forth. So this is the spin down that he measures with the MHD code, and it's very similar to what we get with the force-free. And this is to show that plasma pressure dominates in these current sheets. So this is the ratio of the plasma pressure to magnetic pressure. It's very small over here, but in the current sheets, plasma becomes important. And just on Tuesday, I learned of the new development by Carlos Palenzuela about resistive relativistic MHD. So all of these combinations of different things are now coming together. And what he did there was amazing. He had the full MHD working inside of a neutron star. And then on the outside, it switched to a force-free. So this is the prescription for the current, which switches between a full MHD and a full, what's it called, the ideal MHD and the resistive, the force-free outside. So he gets qualitatively very similar solutions. The problem there is that the current sheet still requires some magic because you still have to force electric field to never exceed the magnetic field. So another recent development is I said that these particle models of the magnetosphere seem to be going towards dead end, but I lied because I think that's still a fundamentally very interesting problem to solve. So what I've recently been playing with is throwing dense plasma at the pulsar magnetosphere with a particle and cell code. So particle and cell models plasma from first principles, so you have both electrons and positrons flying around and as particles, and you record their currents, and you can record how changes in the how currents affect Maxwell's equations. So this is, sorry, right? Yeah. So Deutsch is the vacuum solution. So the vacuum analytic formula for the vacuum solution was first. First derived by Deutsch, it's his name, in 1955. So basically, what I'm solving here is electric and magnetic fields are split into two. There is an analytic formula for the electric and magnetic field of the vacuum field, and then the particles contribute to the electric and magnetic field of the plasma. And it's not a small expansion. These Maxwell's equations are linear, so this is this can be done exactly. So what's shown here is what happens again, two extremes. Just so test particles thrown into this vacuum electromagnetic field, and their Beck reaction is not included. So just test particles. What you find is that electrons and positrons go in completely different directions. So this is the total density of electrons plus positrons, and this is only density of positrons. And you can see all of the features of positrons in the total, but all of the electrons are missing here. So electrons are going somewhere else than the positrons, which is to be expected. And now if I turn on the charges on the particles, you will see that electrons and positrons are now following each other. So now, and the solution starts to become looking more and more like these force-free or MHD solutions. So we can now do this. It's still a work in progress, but I think it's very promising that we can now do this with particles, which means that all of the reconnections can be simulated with more or less faithfully, and you can start getting particle acceleration coming from these current sheets, for example. So this is the one of these snapshots. So the full density versus positive density, and you can see that they're basically following each other. So that's good. That the adding charges has stopped complete charge separation. There is still some charge density, but it's now looking better. Okay, so how badly am I doing on time?
5 minutes.
Okay, so I just want to do one last thing that I wanted to mention. So about emission processes. So we now have these various models for the structure of the magnetosphere and structure for the electromagnetic field. So can we use that to infer something about where the emission is coming from? And what we tried to do is to explain the gamma rays in particular, because those seem to be the most prominent signal in terms of energetics. Let me just, sorry, quickly show you a slide which I missed here. Okay, so this is what gamma ray emission looks like. So what you see typically, and this is Fermi satellite now discovered over 100 gamma ray emitting pulsars. So this is the radio, and this is gamma rays. So you can see that the gamma rays are offset from the radio, and they typically come as double peaks. So here are different examples, double peaks, again, double peaks. Sometimes you don't see the radio, you only see the gamma rays. So the gamma rays seem to be beamed in a wider angle than the radio. So the big question is, what's causing this, and can we understand this from our models? Well, it depends how you do it. So if radio arrives now, then the double peaks arrive after. So, but before the next radio. Right. The thing is spinning, right? So if you define zero as the radio, then the double peaks are coming later. I'm not sure.
Let's say you only see one event.
Right? No, sorry.
This picture of a chair.
The thing is spinning, right? So you
right. No, what we were trying to ask is, can you tie which, so if you see a radio, what is the counterpart of the gamma ray in this screen? Is it much earlier?
I'm not sure. So,
I guess the cartoon picture that I had, which is apparently wrong from what you're saying, is that there's some lighthouse effect, and as the lighthouse sweeps by,
right,
it emits in various frequencies,
right,
and I see the gamma rays and the radio waves,
right.
But from a given sweep of the lighthouse, do I see the gamma rays first or the radio?
Well, the thing is, so what I'm going to argue is that radio and gamma rays are coming from different parts in the magnetosphere. Right, so it's not just one cone. So it turns out the radio is more or less a cone, but then the gamma rays come from another piece of the part in the magnetosphere. Right, that's the story. Right, so let me just switch here. So what we try to do is we try to take these three-dimensional solutions for the geometry and just assign emission along several flux surfaces and just look at where it lands on the sky while taking into account relativistic aberration and time delay. So here's a polar cap of an aligned rotator, and this is 30 degrees, 60 degrees, 90 degrees, so forth. And so what we did is to just, on the star, paint circles like that, and then trace those circles in space to, so this is a field lines of one of these circles, and then assign a mission as if there's plasma flowing along these flux surfaces and beaming relativistically along the magnetic field in the proper frame. So the important effect here is the formation of caustics. So if you have a rotating field and you have emission from different altitudes on this rotating field, if the thing is spinning relativistically, then you will have photons coming from here and photons emitted from here would arrive together in phase because they're being, you know, the first emitting photons are coming in phase with the later emitted photons. So this is kind of a geometrical effect that you will get. So you can get caustics. And indeed, that's what you get. So this is what's shown here are different field lines. So map of field lines and circles on them show just mark different heights along the field lines. And as it's moving, these are the different flux surfaces that I picked on the star. And you can map each of these field lines onto the what we call a sky map. So where would it fall on the towards the observer on the sky? So this shows the phase of the rotation, and this shows the angle of the observer to the pulsar. So each of these rings, say that the red ring is the ring that maps out like this to the sky, and you can see that beyond certain height, these rings are summing together. So you get a caustic emission coming together, and for some of these flux tubes, you can get what will look like a double peak. So this is the sky map. This is phase versus observer angle. This is the bright emission comes in this kind of a curve. So that means that if you're an observer looking, say, at 60 degrees to this pulsar, you will see a peak, and then you will see another peak. So you will see double peaks, right? And only some of these flux surfaces do that. Most of the other ones produce four peaks. So for example, this one would produce four peaks. That's not good. So only some of these flux surfaces are good for this purpose. Okay, so which ones are they? It turns out that these flux surfaces that produce the double peak emission are hugging very closely the surfaces of strong current, this equatorial current sheet that flows outside the magnetosphere. So this tells us that there is something magical about this current sheet, that if this current sheet were to emit photons, we're likely to see double peaks. And if it were to emit photons, probably it's due to some sort of reconnection physics. So what the way this works is that so in terms of phasing, you would see a radio coming right now from the pole, and then you would see one gamma ray pulse right now and another gamma ray pulse sort of right now. If you plot it, for different pulsars, different inclination angles, generically you get these double peaks, which look more or less like the data. I mean, we did more quantitative comparisons, and it's a good idea. So. What this tells us is that we should be looking at some physics related to reconnection. And probably a picture like this is not crazy. So there is some sort of reconnection going on close to the light cylinder, which results in the periodic emission of plasmoids. A picture like this, where basically if you're in the poloidal plane of the pulsar, there is some sort of tearing mode that happens, creates series of islands, and those islands can move fast relativistically from the pulsar, and the emission from these islands will be beamed towards you. So that's the idea, and we're trying to flesh it out with more kinetic simulations, trying to actually do this reconnection simulations for real. Okay, so I'm sorry to run over. Let me just conclude here. So we're now have magnetospheric shape for these pulsars in now three dimensions and various limits. So we have the pure vacuum, pure ideal force-free, pure ideal MHD, and now recent generation of resistive codes, which are now introducing back the electric field, so you can, in principle, study the acceleration in better detail. And I have a lot of expectations from pure kinetic simulations, because I think while completely under-resolved, they will be more interesting, because they will include all of the physics, in principle, self-consistently. And what we're stumbling upon is that reconnection is the important thing. So we didn't expect that. And it seems like the regions that are producing gamma rays are associated with regions of strong current, and that's probably there is probably a reason behind it, and we have to understand when this reconnection is important. So to motivate this for this audience, I guess, so when you're dealing with neutron star mergers or neutron star black hole mergers, you will be, if these objects have magnetospheres, I would expect that there will be pointing flux produced, but pointing flux is not necessarily radiation that we observe. So the two may be completely different animals, as they are in pulsars, right? We don't see pointing flux. What we see is something else. And that something else is probably going to be related to dissipation of currents and very twisted magnetic fields that may be developed during the mergers. And that's what we need to work towards. So just to show you one movie, this is not mergers. This is our simulation of what happens on a magnetar. So on a magnetar, you can have a flux tube that's differentially shearing. And you can see here the flux tube is being blown apart by the stresses that are generated in the toroid. This is what's shown as the toroidal field. And after this plasmoid is emitted, there will be lots of reconnection events happening here. And those are probably the places where you would get radiation from. So this is, I think this is where we need to be thinking if we're actually to predict electromagnetic radiation from mergers. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you. So there are two kinds of things you can do. So yeah, there will be pulse-to-pulse variations, of course. And those will be because you have this flux tube, or, you know, the open flux that on which some sort of cascades are happening. So the radio emission is probably related to some collective plasma oscillations in this column as it flows out. And you know, different pieces of that column may be lighting up for a particular pulse, right? So only on average will you get more or less stable configuration.
So ultimately, it's kind of a noisy process.
It is.
You're never going to be able to sort of make it intrinsically and make it
There will be, I mean, that will always be there. Now, there is another component which is, there is now new realizations about the longer term timing noise. So I don't know about millisecond pulsar in particular, but the regular pulsars show this multi-year variation in spin down. So the timing residuals are looking like there is some quasi-periodic signal on scales of like 10 years.
This is what they call red noise.
Yeah, right. So, and the recently people understood that there is also spin down rate changes associated with it. So you can actually see that the pulsar is changing its evolution over time. And that the time scale for that is uncertain to me. But the fact that you can see the variations in the spin down means that there is some global magnetospheric process that's happening. And what's controlling that may be some sort of reconnection process at the Y point, but why there would be a 10-year time scale, which is completely out of much longer than any kind of time scale you can imagine. Maybe it's some sort of internal crust motions, but it's hard to say. So I think there is promise, but I won't guarantee you that we'll understand this. And I think we now have more data to have at least it's clear that it's not completely random. Like there's red noise, there is some periodicity to it. So there's hope that we can understand that. But pulse-to-pulse variations will be much harder.